I'm going to be talking about a recent paper that I wrote with Bob about the relationship between Newtonian and relativistic cosmologies. Okay, so this is the outline of my talk. First, I'm going to explain how to do cosmology within the context of Newtonian gravity. And this is what forms the basis of structure formation simulations. And a while ago, when computers weren't so powerful, those simulation boxes were limited to be, you know, quite small compared to the Hubble radius. But now they can be even larger than the Hubble radius. And then the question is, well, how is that related to general relativity, which is what the universe actually follows? So there are a few issues which you might be worried about. In Newtonian gravity, forces are instantaneous, and in relativity, they're causal. Relative velocities for objects which are far apart in Newtonian cosmology are much higher than the speed of light, and well, that's not allowed in relativity. So we're interested in how these simulations would relate to relativity. So it turns out that there's in fact an exact correspondence with GR in the linearized regime. And in the Newtonian regime, there's also a correspondence. But these are two different regimes, and it's not clear how to put them together. So to do that, I'm going to explain this general approximation framework that Bob and I have developed, which is suitable for treating this sort of situation. And then I'm going to propose a tentative dictionary to map a Newtonian simulation into a GR spacetime. And then we'll ask, within the context of this framework, how well does it solve Einstein's equation? And then I'll see that it doesn't solve it quite as well as we'd like, so then I'll explain how to improve the dictionary and then conclude. So, as I've said, you know, you can do cosmology entirely within the context of Newtonian gravity, and provided you restrict yourself to dust and a cosmological constant. So Newtonian gravity solutions are characterized by a potential function phi, energy density rho, and a velocity field v. And then we impose the Newton's equation, where we've added a cosmological constant, the mass conservation equation, and the Euler equation. So then there in fact exists a cosmological background solution. So if you assume rho is a function of t, phi is a function of t and r, and vi is a function of t times x, so you have this radial velocity field, you can plug this into your equations and derive that h obeys the Friedmann equations of relativity. Now there's a few differences compared to general relativity cosmology because, well, this k here is a constant of integration. It has nothing to do with spatial curvature, but it characterizes whether or not the universe will expand forever or contract in on itself. Well, your velocities, again, as you move out in x, they can exceed the speed of light. So there's a few differences. And also, this wasn't discovered until after, you know, relativistic cosmology, because it's kind of a peculiar solution. Usually when you deal with isolated systems in Newtonian gravity, you assume the field falls off at infinity, but here it grows as r squared. I mean, so it's a bit strange that way, but it works and it gives you a solution. And it can, in fact, be understood. It's not that surprising because, well, in both Newtonian gravity and in general relativity, if you have spherical symmetry, then a ball of dust behaves the same no matter what's going on outside that ball of dust. So you could take take a homogeneous cosmological solution and exclude all the matter outside a small ball, and that small ball will still behave the same way. And then for a small ball in both Newtonian gravity, general relativity should reduce to Newtonian gravity if it's small enough and the velocities are small enough. So you get the same equations for that small ball, so you should get the same equations for your entire universe. Of course, now the actual cosmology is not entirely homogeneous and isotropic, so we need to discuss perturbations. And we'll just define some perturbation variables like the velocity vn, which is the velocity with compared to the Hubble velocity. Delta n will be the fractional density perturbation, and psi n will be the perturbation of the field. The n's here just denote Newtonian. And then these perturbative quantities obey these three equations. Now, unlike in the background case, these three equations are not identical to the nonlinear Einstein equation for dust. So we're interested in how they will relate to that, to Einstein's equation, though. Well, at first, we could linearize the equations and see what happens. So that would entail dropping this and this. We do that, then it turns out that they are identical to the scalar linearized equations for dust with k equals 0 when you express them in terms of Bardeen's variables. So here you can see, I mean, these are Bardeen's variables. If you associate phi a to psi n, epsilon m to delta n, and vs to vn, then you get exactly the same equations. So I don't really have any sort of physical reason why this should hold, like I did in the case of the background, but it seems to be true. Moreover, you can extend this to the vector case. If we associate the vector part of vn to vc, and then we define this Bardeen variable psi I to solve this Poisson equation here. Now psi I could be thought of as similar to the.
So could we just say that it's not that you're interested in a scalar mode, there is no propagating degree of freedom?
Yeah, the propagating degree of freedom is in the matter sector for the scalar.
If matter has no pressure,
yeah.
Then there is indeed no propagating degree of freedom.
Right.
You have
the degree of freedom in the matter in terms of, like, you have to define an initial density field and a velocity field to determine your evolution afterwards, right? So there.
But that doesn't, if it's linear as well, nothing really propagates.
I'm not quite sure I know what you mean in that case.
I mean, density at different points evolve independent of each other.
Yeah, that's a consequence of the equations. It's very different from the tensor case where you have these propagating degrees of freedom
and
gravity.
So then the same argument that you have for the homogeneous cosmology works for the linear perturbation
theory. I don't know of a reason why. I mean, that seems, it follows, yeah, it follows from the equations, sorry. If you want to write down these equations and you Fourier decompose them in spatial directions, then yeah, each Fourier mode would follow, would obey an ordinary differential equation in time, and they're not coupled or anything.
No, but even in real space, okay.
I mean, I don't see how to see it from any sort of physical argument other than from, like, looking at the equations and seeing that it works. But I don't know. We could talk later if you have an idea. But anyway, at the vector level, so this, like I was saying, this psi I is related to, like, the zero I components of the metric perturbation. And it doesn't enter into any other equations, so that you can just define it to be equal to that and you're done. And your equation for VC, which is another, the vector part of the velocity, it's already satisfied Newtonian gravity. So you have the scalar and vector correspondence. Of course, yeah, as you were mentioning, at the tensor level, that's where you have the propagating degrees of freedom in GR. And there's nothing analogous in Newtonian gravity. All the degrees of freedom are contained in the matter sector. So there's no correspondence at that level, but you could just set the tensor perturbation to be zero if you want to make a correspondence. Anyway, now that we have the Bardeen variables, we can then produce a space-time and metric and a matter distribution in any coordinate system. And we're going to be using the longitudinal gauge for this talk because it's quite straightforward. There's no gauge degrees of freedom. The perturbation variables in this gauge are algebraically related to the Bardeen variables as opposed to related through, like, a differential equation. So we'll be using that. Okay, so are we done then? Because we have the correspondence at the linearized level. Well, you actually have a problem if you want to use the linearized Einstein equation, which is, well, suppose I write down the linearized Einstein equation. The G1 is the linearized Einstein tensor, where we've dropped all nonlinear terms. We'll take its divergence, and with respect to, we're working off of a flat background here, sorry. And if we take the divergence with the partial derivative operator, then the linearized Bianchi identity tells you that the stress energy tensor is conserved with respect to the partial derivative operator. And what this means then, in the general background case, like FLRW, it means that the dust matter has to follow geodesics of the background, and you don't get any self-interaction, so that the Earth won't go around the sun if you impose the linearized Einstein equation. So it's inconsistent to assume both a linearized Einstein equation and nonlinear matter motion, because as is standard in GR, that the Einstein equation itself determines the matter motion. So a related issue is in linearized gravity. Not only is the metric perturbation required to be small, but also stress energy perturbation has to be small. So this is clearly violated in the universe, where the Earth is much denser than the surrounding medium. So this isn't totally satisfactory, and we need to look at a different regime, which is the Newtonian regime. So this is a different sort of limit. And instead of assuming that all perturbative quantities are small, we do assume that velocities and metric perturbations are small, but we also assume spatial distances to be small, and we don't assume that matter fluctuations are. So the precise scaling is determined by the Newtonian equations of motion, but we can look at like a picture like this. All I'm doing here, this is like some planet orbiting a sun or something, and I'm shrinking it down, and I'm indicating the velocities are getting smaller, the distances are getting smaller. And this is how you do a Newtonian limit. Now, you're probably also familiar with Newtonian limits being where you take the speed of light to infinity, and that's totally equivalent so long as you rescale, you change your coordinate system and you rescale your units. So it's the same sort of thing, but I think for our purposes, where we have a small parameter, which is like the ratio of the size of a small-scale perturbation to the Hubble scale, that's the parameter we're thinking about it, it's most useful to look at it this way. So this is how we expect small scales to work in the universe. And this was studied by Olnick in the cosmological case a couple of years ago, where he proved existence of solutions. He proved existence of solutions to Einstein's equation, which limit to these Newtonian solutions. But the issue with Olnick's work is that he did this on a torus, like for the spatial slices. But in his limit, the torus, its size had to shrink down to zero. So he's explicitly excluding long wavelength cosmological perturbations. So that's excluding the other case that we're interested in making consistent. But his work does indicate that small scale should be Newtonian. Okay, so again, we can find a mapping which takes the Newtonian variables into the space-time metric and matter variables. But it turns out the mapping is different from the mapping in linearized gravity and longitudinal gauge. So I think I neglected to mention this, but under this mapping, these scalar variables convert into things like the time-time component of the metric perturbation, the phi A does, the VS goes directly into the velocity perturbation, but epsilon M doesn't convert directly into the density perturbation in this gauge. The density perturbation in this gauge is some linear combination of epsilon M and phi, so it's a non-trivial dictionary in that sense, which I'll come to later, but in the Newtonian limit case, it's the density maps into the density, so they're different that way. So then, with that introduction out of the way, yeah.
In the first case, you said that the Bianchi identity doesn't apply. Can you explain this part again?
This bit? Okay. Yes.
Non-linear.
Yeah, so in general relativity, the motion of bodies is determined by the Einstein equation, right? As opposed, you don't have to impose additional matter equations to determine how it moves. And likewise, if you impose, if this didn't have the one on it, then I could take the divergence of GAB with respect to the covariant derivative associated with G, and then that would tell me that this is conserved covariantly, and that would give me my motion for bodies, right? But I am going to get, if I say G1 is equal to TAB, then I have a different Bianchi identity holding with the partial derivative operator. So that tells me that the matter stress energy is conserved with respect to the partial derivative operator. And you need these, the difference between this derivative operator and the covariant derivative operator is going to be given by these Christoffel symbols, which give you like the Newtonian forces. So those are going to be explicitly omitted in this situation. This is going to give you the matter equations of motion, but without any Newtonian forces appearing.
So you're saying that the Einstein tensor is not satisfying the Bianchi identity with respect to the background.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, this satisfies Bianchi identity with respect to the background,
okay,
as opposed to with respect to the exact metric. Yes. Is that clear? Parameterized post-Newton? I mean, I don't really know how to fit that into that, but I mean, I'm just considering Einstein gravity here, so there's no need to think about other theories other than Einstein gravity, I don't think. In terms of trying to, you know, calculate post-Newtonian corrections to motion and stuff, that wouldn't be allowed when you're imposing the linearized Einstein equation. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Okay, so where was I? Here. Okay, so with that introduction out of the way, the question is, you know, we're doing these big simulations now, and how can we trust results from such simulations when the actual universe is relativistic? And how do we interpret the results as a relativistic space-time? So I've talked about both of those things, and we have reason to think that it should work, because, well, at the background level, we have the exact correspondence. For large-scale perturbations, we have an exact correspondence with linearized GR. For small-scale perturbations, we expect Newtonian behavior in GR for small velocities. But the degree to which Einstein's equation is not solved by nonlinear terms due to small scales can be larger than the degree to which we want to solve it at large scales, because those terms are bigger. So it's not clear how to do this. What we'd like to do is maybe average over small scales and then get out a large scale description. And as I've said before, you know, these Newtonian and linearized limits in GR are very different, and they're not obviously compatible. And we have these two different dictionaries. So how do we fit this together in a consistent approximation scheme? So in a couple of slides, I'm going to explain how to do this using this framework that we've developed for analyzing perturbations. Okay. So now this is just defining my variables and stating the problem precisely. So given a solution, which is these three functions of the cosmological Newtonian equations of motion on a torus, we wish to generate a space-time metric G and a dust stress energy tensor, and we wish to know to what degree these solve Einstein's equation. So to what degree is what I'm going to answer with our approximation scheme. And we're going to work in longitudinal gauge, where we have two scalar perturbations, A and HL. We have a vector perturbation, which is divergence-free BI. and tensor perturbation HIJ, which is transverse and traceless. And we then we also have our matter perturbation VI, which is the peculiar velocity, and the fractional density perturbation. So we want a mapping between these three variables into these. One thing I should note is that in this gauge can always be chosen in linearized gravity, but it's not clear that you can always do this when you're not imposing the linearized Einstein equation. So we're thinking of it more as a metric ansatz, and it's fine if we do that because we'll show that we can find these variables.
Do you have the same number of degrees of freedom?
Pardon?
It seems that in the relativistic case, you have more degrees of freedom.
Yeah, you do. You have the HIJ, which has the tensor degrees of freedom, which are not present in Newtonian gravity. And but what we'll find is that these degrees of freedom can be, it's pretty intuitively clear that these degrees of freedom can be sourced by matter moving around. And we'll just, to get our solution to the degree we're interested in, we're just going to see that, you know, we'll have to make a correction like that. But it can potentially be ignored if we're not interested in that. So, okay. So now to talk about the approximation scheme. So what we were interested in our previous work was how to calculate the effect, or say whether there is an effect, where small-scale nonlinear motion can affect the background dynamics of the universe. So there is one situation where that's possible, and it's not as far-fetched as it seems, because if you have a universe filled with gravitational radiation, then that should behave the same way at large scales as a universe filled with electromagnetic radiation. Now the difference, and it does, and the difference though is that the electromagnetic radiation sources, when you average it out, it sources the expansion of the universe through the Maxwell stress energy tensor, but the gravitational waves will source the expansion through the second order Einstein tensor. Like the nonlinear terms in the Einstein tensor, you move them over to the other side of the equation, and they act as an effective stress energy tensor. So in that situation, I mean, like the sorts of perturbations we have in mind would be, we would have H would be, you know, small amplitude times something like sine X over lambda. So this lambda it denotes like the ratio of the spatial extent of a perturbation to the Hubble scale. That's small. This is small, the amplitude. So we have a small metric perturbation, but
those are the same lambdas?
Yeah, they're the same lambdas. So I mean, you could have some constants in here, so they don't have to be numerically exactly the same. But what's called the shortwave approximation, and it's a way. I mean, this would really be k mu x mu for some k. So if that's what's bothering you, maybe.
Okay.
But the thing is, you scale the solution with lambda, and so let's see. So if you do this, then take the derivative, and then this is like cosine x over lambda, and that's you know, much bigger than you would be allowed in ordinary perturbation theory, which is what we're trying to generalize. And it allows us to have significant nonlinearity at small scales. And you take two derivatives, that's going to go as 1 over lambda. So that basically means that we're taking lambda small. Then you can have if the second derivative is large, then if you're going to source this by a stress energy tensor, that stress energy tensor is allowed to have a large perturbation. Anyway, so that this is the shortwave approximation. In our previous work, we treated it rigorously, and we extended it to the non-vacuum case. And we believe this sort of approach is quite suitable for analyzing the cosmological situation we're interested in here. So we have this small parameter epsilon, which measures the deviation of the metric from the background. Well, I called it lambda there, but I'm calling it epsilon over here. And in contrast to ordinary perturbation theory, we're going to allow first derivative of gamma to be order 1 instead of order, requiring them to be order epsilon. And second space-time derivatives are allowed to be order 1 over epsilon. And then, like I just said, if since stress energy perturbations are related to the metric perturbations through the Einstein equation, this tells you that the stress energy perturbations can be order 1 over epsilon. But as a consequence, now look what happens in this case for if you have quadratic products. So if you have dH squared, that's what appears in the second order Einstein tensor. And then this is cosine squared x over lambda, which averages out to a half. So you get an order 1 kind of back reaction effect, and that's how the shortwave approximation takes into account the energy density of the gravitational waves. So we have to worry about that in this situation, and it can potentially back react on the background metric. However, the main result of our previous work is that the back reaction can only take the form of a traceless effective stress energy tensor with positive energy density, which corresponds to gravitational waves, provided that the true matter stress energy tensor has positive energy density. So whereas we're allowing these perturbations to be sourced by density perturbations, there is no new effect due to the scalar perturbations. As, you might have thought there could be, but there isn't. It just corresponds to this gravitational radiation. But anyways, in this work, we're going to assume there's negligible gravitational radiation, so the background metric obeys the ordinary Einstein equation. Yes?
So that sounds like a very interesting result. So can you tell us what the crux of the argument
is? Well, the crux of the argument is, well, here. So look at this. Yeah. I'll tell you the argument. So look at this example we've been looking at, right? If we're going to say, we want to say this is equal to rho, right? Or delta, right? But look, this goes arbitrarily negative as lambda goes to 0. So this is not allowed to be sourced by a matter perturbation. That's one way of seeing it, why this example fails. The general proof's more complicated, but it relies crucially on matter having positive energy density. And I mean, we can talk about it later. You can look at my other paper, but it takes a while to get through it. But that's the basic.
I'm just wondering if you say you have a gas and black hole.
Black holes won't work. Well, it won't apply because I'm assuming the metric perturbation is small. That's the main reason. But you could, if you had black holes, you could replace a black hole by a star of the same mass, and I don't think that should change the overall evolution. Yeah.
You've assumed a homogeneous isotropic universe.
Sorry?
You've assumed a homogeneous isotropic universe.
For the background, yeah, that's what we're going to be assuming.
But there are inhomogeneous exact solutions, Einstein solutions. So. Which could also form a background.
Yeah, potentially like the LTB or something.
In this case, this result holds.
So our general result holds for any background metric GAB0. But the background metric could obey different evolution. Right. This if we work the result for an arbitrary background GAB0. So if you assume FLRW symmetry, then that will obey the Friedman equations with just this extra source. But if you don't assume FLRW symmetry, then you don't have the Friedman equations, obviously, and you'd have the LTB equations or whatever you want to.
So if you take an LTB background, do you still have this result of only the traceless energy?
Yeah, due to the perturbations off of that background.
It
doesn't depend on the background, no. You get that arbitrary. So. Okay. Okay, then for perturbations, like I said, we want to treat small and large scales differently. So where at small scales you have the nonlinearity, at large scales you want the linearized Einstein equation to hold. So what we're going to do is define an averaging operator. So if we assume there's a homogeneity scale such that density perturbations are small beyond the scale, then we can define, using a window function, like the average of a quantity f, to be basically F smeared over a region of size L. So then we can split a quantity F into a long wavelength part, which is the averaged part, plus the small scale part, which behaves nonlinearly, which is just the remainder. So what I said about derivatives contributing factors of 1 over epsilon, that only applies to the small scale part and not the large scale part under the averaging operator. And that just follows from the definition. Because you can pop it, if you have a derivative on something here, you can pop it over to the WL, which has compact support, and it won't affect it. So in our previous paper then, we derived this modified linearized Einstein equation for gamma L, which it looks like a big mess, but you know, this is just, the box stuff is just the ordinary linearized Einstein equation. So you have the, you know, all that normal stuff with the gamma L, you have a linearized stress energy tensor, but then you have all these other terms like with a whole bunch of indices, and these are all averages of products of short wavelength quantities. So like alpha, which appears over here, that's going to be the average of that. Okay, so this is like second order Einstein tensor, and due to the fact that we have gravitational radiation potentially in the background, you have these terms like omega with 8 indices, and that comes from like, you know, terms with 3 metric perturbations and 2 derivatives in the Einstein tensor. But in the case of dust, most of these terms will vanish and we don't need to worry about them. So we want to solve this equation, and we're going to do so. So now to answer, to what degree do we wish to solve Einstein's equation? Well, let's look at this at small scales. So here's the perturbation to the Einstein tensor, just the exact minus the background. And I've just written out the sorts of terms that you would see appearing. So the dominant term is the dd gamma type term. And that's order 1 over epsilon. You get an epsilon and 2 1 over epsilons from the derivatives. And this is what allows for large delta. Then, just expanding it some more, the leading nonlinear terms are like the d gamma, d gamma. And if you count orders, that's order 1, and this is also order 1. And this we want to keep. So we definitely want to keep these terms because they're the leading nonlinear terms. So we're going to say we want to solve to order 1 at small scales. That's where that leading nonlinearity comes in. And at large scales, we want to solve the linearized Einstein equation, this one. So that's an order epsilon equation. So we're going to say order epsilon at large scales. So here are our assumptions for a Newtonian solution. So we're going to, like I said, we're going to assume we're given a Newtonian solution which has this behavior. So let's look at this. So we're assuming, it looks a bit faint, but psi n, we're going to say is order epsilon. We're going to say at small scales, at di, the spatial derivative operator contributes a factor of 1 over epsilon when you take a derivative. Vi is epsilon the 1/2, delta is 1 over epsilon. D0, the time derivative, is epsilon to the minus 1/2. These might look arbitrary, but these keep the Newtonian equations invariant. And this is the same sort of scaling that, yeah.
So your epsilon is the same as lambda?
Yeah, sorry, I used it at lambda. Yeah, it's the same thing. And this is the same sort of scaling that Futamasi and Schutz use once you translate their paper into this, where you scale the distances, like I explained. So this is where that comes from. But at large scales, we're assuming everything to order epsilon, right? Because we want linear behavior at large scales. And I've put ones for the derivatives just to indicate the derivatives don't do anything when you take a derivative at large scales. But then you produce all these composite quantities. So a derivative acting on psi is order 1 at small scales. D psi is order 1, so on. But at large scales, what do you have? Well, if you take a derivative, if you take a derivative of psi and then average it, like I explained, you can pop that derivative onto the averaging kernel, and then this becomes order epsilon. This is much more interesting, this d psi, that's actually order epsilon because of what I was saying before. This is when I was talking about the general framework, because you could be concerned that this would cause a back reaction effect. When you count it out, it's order 1. But what we proved is that under averaging, even though it's a priori order 1, since the matter stress energy has positive energy density, yeah, it's actually proven to be order epsilon. So that was the main result of our previous paper, And it comes about because this is bounded from below. Any questions about this slide? Yeah.
So how the cross terms end up with nonlinear terms?
Yeah.
So I understand how you decompose the short scale and large scale linear equation.
Yeah, you basically have to do that. Yeah.
So there is you can't decompose this to the tangential.
Yeah, that's right.
So back into the your perturbed tangent equation. How do you decompose the large and small scales?
Well, the way I'm doing it is I'm saying, okay, we'll look at this. This is, you know, these are two small scale quantities, and I'm taking the derivatives and multiplying them together and averaging them. And I'm going to call that a large scale quantity because it doesn't vary. This obviously cannot vary over scales smaller than my averaging scale because I've defined it that way, right? But you do have this kind of correlation possibility between these small scale objects, right?
But the question is, what happens with large and small cross terms?
Yeah, well, large small cross terms are going to be, let's figure this out. So we have, so you're thinking like d psi s times d. D psi L, like that?
Yeah.
Okay, well, if we average, so let's just look at this. So this, that's order epsilon, right? That bit. This is order one, right? But what we can do is when we put in the averaging kernel, we can pop the derivatives over in two ways. Like, we get the derivative we'll move the derivative over onto this, so that's still order epsilon times order epsilon. And then when the derivative goes over onto the averaging kernel, then this is going to be order epsilon. The averaging kernel won't do anything still. So this whole thing, when you average it, it's order epsilon. Well, it's order epsilon squared. Let me sort this out. It's order epsilon squared. Right?
I don't know.
So this is order epsilon, and I just argued that I can remove the derivative from this. So this is order epsilon 2. So then when I average it, it's order epsilon squared. And it doesn't contribute to this equation at all.
Okay. You say so.
Yeah, well, I can explain more later, I guess. Okay, where was I? Here. So then this is how I count orders. And I said what orders I want to solve it to. So I'm going to start by this tentative dictionary that I mentioned. So this dictionary is actually motivated from the linearized exact correspondence. And this is the non-trivial bit I was talking about. So like I said, this delta n is equal to epsilon m from Bardeen's variables, but it's not equal to delta in longitudinal gauge. We have to add in this other stuff. Then I've also defined bi, this is the vector part. The a and the hl are psi n. Here I've had to subtract off, this denotes like a totally homogeneous infinite wavelength part because otherwise I wouldn't be able to solve the Poisson equation there at a corresponding correction up there. Here this v denotes vector part. Anyway, if I ignore the vector parts, then this is the same dictionary as what was written out by Cesari and Zaldarriaga in the same year. They had a similar paper about the same topic. With that dictionary, how well does this solve Einstein's equation? And remember, the orders we want to solve it to are order 1 at small scales and order epsilon at large scales. Okay, well, let's just plug it in. So here's the 0, 0 component of Einstein's equation. First, I'm going to plug in the coordinate system and keeping all the terms that could possibly end up contributing. Then on the second line, I have substituted the dictionary that I just written down. So now all the HL and stuff is replaced by Newtonian quantities. And on the third line, I've imposed the Poisson equation. So the Laplacian of psi is equal to delta. And then I'm left with this. So, you know, it's motivated by the linearized correspondence. All the linear terms have dropped out as expected. But there's important nonlinear terms which are still here. We wanted to solve this to order one at small scales. These terms are all order one at small scales, and we haven't set it to zero yet. So we need to do a bit better than this. And at order at large scales, they're all order epsilon also. So we need to do better. How are we going to improve the dictionary? So any questions at this point before I move on? Good. Okay.
So, yeah. Sir, are you suggesting that these corrections need to be included in learning simulation?
Yeah, I mean, you could potentially include them. I'm going to argue that they're small corrections in the end. Yeah, but I mean, it's more important as a matter of principle that they can be found, because if you couldn't find these corrections, then you'd be in trouble.
When you say it's order one, I'm trying to understand. Does that mean it's small?
Order one, I want, like I said before, I want to solve to order one at small scales. So, because I want to allow nonlinear behavior at small scales. So, I want to get I want to solve Einstein's equation to order one, and since these are order one, my failure to satisfy the Einstein equation so far is at order one. I need to do better.
Okay, but my point is that when you say order one, but in physical units, it's really 10^-5, like for anything.
It turns out, yeah, sure, but okay, I'm just gonna go on. So, since I don't want to run out of time. So the way I'm correcting this is. I'm going to do two types of corrections. The first is I'm going to correct the bi source to make it nonlinear. So I'll add the delta here. So it's 1 plus delta times b, which is just kind of an obvious one from the momentum constraint. And then the other type is I'm going to allow additional scalar and a tensor correction, which are arbitrary so far, but I'm going to determine them. And then we'll see, so how does this our county scheme work? Well, this delta times V is, delta is order 1 over epsilon. V is order epsilon to 1/2. So this is epsilon 1 over epsilon to the half. So it's consistent then to assign the order epsilon to the 3/2 to B, because I take two derivatives of that, I get back 1 over epsilon to 1/2. To the short wavelength part of V, sorry. Long wavelength part is still order epsilon. So, and we're going to assume that these, that the chi and xi and jij are all order epsilon at small scales, and we'll see that that's consistent. So, to proceed, I'm just going to go quickly through this. We're going to just plug in our equations that we have so far into the Einstein equation, simplify, find out how to find chi, xi, and jij. The systematic way to do this is I'm just going to look at different components of the Einstein equation, like the time-time, time-space, and space-space, and then decompose everything into scalar, vector, tensor parts as I can. So for example, if I take the double divergence of the traceless part of EIJ, that gives me this equation once I've substituted the Newtonian equations and into it. And then, well, look at this equation. So this is, this equation, okay. Before I took the double divergence, this equation was order one, and I wanted to solve it to order one, right? Take the double divergence, now it's order one over epsilon squared. So I want to solve it to order one over epsilon squared, so I've dropped terms smaller than that. And you look at these terms, this is order one, but there's two more derivatives acting on it, so on. But anyways, the whole equation turns out to be just a double Poisson equation for xi, which we can solve on spatial slices, no problem. And we'll take that to be the definition for xi. And then you can show after some work that you get your order one solution just by setting, you know, by solving these Poisson or double Poisson equations for all your new variables. And the reason why they're all Poisson equations is that because the time derivatives are small compared to space derivatives at small scales, so you can neglect them. And you know, these are post-Newtonian type corrections to the metric, and they're important in principle, but negligible in practice. So that's what you were asking. I mean, you could go and calculate them, and now you find, I mean, the point of the exercise is to see that you can do this in cosmology and also get the large scale part right. But So you could, if you want, you can go calculate them, find them order epsilon squared, and say, okay, we didn't care about them anyway. But we're showing that you can do it. So going on, we have our order one solution at small scales. Now we'll get the order epsilon solution at large scales. So again, what I'm going to be doing is adding some arbitrary terms, just denoted by capital letters this time. So a delta, J, X, C, a PI. We'll substitute the dictionary into the equation, apply the averaging operator, the bracket operator to the Einstein equation, and impose the Newtonian equations and all these defining equations on the previous slide, work it through, and look what we get. Well, we have two differential equations we need to solve. First, we'll solve this equation for capital X. It's a differential equation in time. And, you know, it's actually, you might think, well, why are we introducing new degrees of freedom, apparently, into this solution? And we're not. These are just the same degrees of freedom that are present already in the dust matter sector. So you do have this freedom to define your solution, but you can think of it, in a sense, as the same freedom as you have to, you know, add a different linearized solution to your already existing linearized solution of the Einstein equation. Now, the thing is, you can't just set X to be equal to zero because it's sourced by stuff which is non-vanishing. So you see how it kind of modifies your solution over time. But of course, in the tensor case, this is what I think you were asking earlier. You get these, you can source your tensor perturbations by these anisotropic stresses here. And those are new, corresponding to long wavelength gravitational waves. And then afterwards, this is all totally prescribed with no freedom. You just see PI and delta have equations which they satisfy. And then, as I mentioned before, you know, X seems to have these two additional degrees of freedom, and you might want to kind of reduce any spurious effect by, say, requiring two conditions at some initial time, like delta and PI are equal to zero. Okay, so then this is the entire dictionary, which you've seen already. These small-scale orders are all small, as we expected, so we believe we can neglect them. There is an interesting effect here, which just you'll agree with it when I'm done writing it out. I mean, these long wavelength parts, in fact, have an infinite wavelength part, which I'm denoting by the over bars. And so what we can do is like define a modified scale factor, because this is in the 0, 0 component, ij components. We can define a modified scale factor, a hat, and we find that it satisfies a Friedmann equation with these effective energy densities and pressures. So these are just the standard energy densities and pressures, but they're modified by the including gravitational potential and kinetic energy. So it's like the difference between the ADM mass and the rest mass. So meanwhile, there's also the JIJ bar, and that would correspond to a perturbation to an anisotropically expanding model. And this, we believe, is the dominant effect of the long wavelength contributions. And it really shows how, like, the extent of what you can do with back reaction if you have large-scale homogeneity and isotropy. So finally, I mean, like I said, we expect these corrections to be small in realistic cosmologies. And it should therefore be acceptable to use an abridged dictionary, which is the one that Cesare and Zaldarriaga have written down. If you're using a small simulation box, I would argue that you can neglect these terms, because at small scales, delta should be much larger than your Newtonian potential. I've omitted the vector perturbations here because they decay in cosmology, but if you were interested in them, you could just include them. So the main purpose in obtaining this complete dictionary is to evaluate the accuracy of the abridged dictionary. So we believe then that we would have confidence that the Newtonian cosmology is accurately representing a relativistic spacetime. That's it. Questions? Yep.
There are exact homogeneous solutions of our Einstein equation.
Yes.
One of them is the related form of the problem. And also, solutions by Schechter's.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with those ones.
Anyway, they could apply to a lot of cosmology, for example, white cosmology, because collapse of collaborators.
Sorry, I couldn't quite hear you say.
The void cosmology.
Okay.
Chris Klotz and collaborators, others. Recent paper out of Oxford.
Yeah.
And the claim is that they can fit all the data that are on CDF fits.
Yeah.
There's some controversy about this.
I'm not sure they can fit everything.
But they are violating your assumptions.
They're not violating. I mean, yeah, they're not violating.
The epsilon is already bounded there.
Yeah.
So there is no.
So what they're really interested in. I mean, I don't know if this is what your question is leading up to, but they're interested in what I would call a large-scale perturbation, not the small-scale perturbations, which what we were evaluating the effect of. So we're not. I mean, we're not really making a statement about the viability of those models.
Okay. So the problem is that this white cosmology piece. It's not completely different from ours in the sense that the universe is not accelerating cosmological zero.
Yeah.
There is no dark energy.
Yeah.
There's no modification of Einstein's equation.
Yeah.
So one begins to feel that you don't quite understand what we're doing.
Well, I would just say that our work is not in contradiction with anything that they're saying. I mean, the only way it would be related is if you wanted to consider one of their models with all kinds of tiny perturbations on top of that, then we would say those tiny perturbations don't do anything. I mean, that's the extent.
Because one of the problems with these models is that they haven't completely worked out growth structure. Because it's non-linear and homogeneous. This is an outstanding problem, which people claim that we solve. It's not yet so.
Yeah, well, they have to fit all kinds of you know, CMB data and stuff too. From what I understood, with some of the issues were like they only have one additional free function or two, I don't know, compared to lambda CDM. But if you set both of them, then if you extend way back in time, it's like you're kind of exciting too many of the decaying modes in the standard cosmology, so they all blow up in the patch. So, I mean, maybe they've got around that. I don't really know.
They're working.
Yeah.
So I have a question on the back reaction of the second order derivatives on the on the background matrix.
Yeah. So.
So how would this disappear?
Oh, this it's actually really straightforward. So so this is order epsilon or lambda, I guess, on this board. This is actually also order epsilon when you average it, right? Because you can pop the derivatives onto the averaging kernel. And this one too is order epsilon when you average it, because you can just do that process twice and you can just move the, I mean, right, if you want to, if you're writing your average, sorry, d squared h, that's equal to like an integral with some compact support object times d squared h, that's equal to minus df dh, which is equal to plus d squared f h. So this is smooth compact support. I guess you can't see that. The h is order epsilon, so it has no back reaction effect. The main one we were worried about would be stuff like dh squared, which doesn't easily average to zero.
I guess one question is, how do you proceed from here? Do you want to proceed from here? So you finish the problem, there's nothing else.
Yeah, I if you have any ideas of things to look at, I mean, it seems like the interesting thing would be if you could find a significant back reaction somewhere. But I think that's difficult to do just because of the weak energy condition, I think, probably is obeyed by most matter that I know about.
If there are no other questions, Stephen will be here today and some part tomorrow. Chat with him in office 223.
222. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks.